Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Gary LeMaster is here with me today.
Good morning.
Mike's off for the day, and we have with us a guest here in the studio, Fred Duval. He's worked in the Clinton White House. He was director of intergovernmental affairs. He's been on the board of regents of the university here in Arizona for many years. He's had one appointed post after another. He's run for office. He's considering a run for governor. So, Fred, welcome. Tell us a little bit about yourself. You were raised in Tucson.
Yes, thank you. Welcome the opportunity to be with you and your listeners. I was raised in Tucson. Came here in the early 60s. My dad was named the founding dean of the medical school in Tucson when it was nothing but an idea. Stayed in Tucson through my education. Met a young lawyer from Flagstaff, Bruce Babbitt, in 1974, and he recruited me to run his campaign for attorney general as a young pup, and spent my first time in Sedona here with him in his cabin and back beyond, and fell in love with this wonderful place. In the course of working for Bruce Babbitt, he became governor. I joined his staff, led his legislative programs.
That was a really progressive time, and not in so much in the political sense, but in terms of making progress in Arizona, right?
When it was a different climate, and one, you know, digress, because it was a different environment and one that we need to get back to. He had a relationship with probably the most skilled legislator of our, Republican legislator of our time, a guy named Burton Barr, and there was a gentleman, Alfredo Gutierrez, who was the Democratic leader, and these were folks who would, you know, arm wrestle and fight, but they would inevitably get together and say, okay, here's what I really want to try and get done for the state. What do you want to get done? How do we work together? And so, you know, there's a lot of fighting on the margins, but we got a groundwater code. We built a Phoenix freeway system. We built Access, the last Medicaid program in the United States, but we did it with in a managed care model, now a best practice. It's really big. Groundwater code was huge at its time. Really, really big, substantial accomplishments done on a bipartisan basis.
So they're all accomplishments that people now take for granted. People don't remember when it was really, really hard to get across Phoenix. Or if they do remember, they don't remember how that got done. And it took a combination of the governor, Democrats and Republicans coming together to get these major developmental projects through.
Well, and you know, I'll digress and get back to the bio in a second, but really the freeway story is a perfect illustration of how this works. The Access story as well. The Phoenix freeway system had to be built. Everybody knew it. The business community came into a Democratic governor and said, look, this has to happen to move goods across this growing valley. And the governor said, look, I understand that. I agree with you on principle. I'll tell you what I want. We've got the lowest teacher salaries in the United States. You support me at the legislature in upgrading teacher salaries by 30%, and I will commit to supporting a half-cent sales tax for transportation. That's what went down. That was good for the state on both halves of that deal. Access was the same way. The progressives are saying, gee, we got to have Medicaid. We've got to get these federal funds. We've got to provide patient care for these patients. And how could we be a state that's paying into the federal fund, but we're not getting our share of it? The Republicans are saying, yeah, but the Medicaid model is a fee-for-service model. Costs are skyrocketing. It's eating state budgets. And so, okay, how do we do this differently? Well, can we manage care? Can we create a competitive model where different providers compete to provide the care for certain population universes? Well, took that to Washington. Reagan White House, Democratic Governor Reagan White House, in a bipartisan group, and went back and said, here's a different model. To this day, what are we, 30 years later, we are still on an exemption. We have a what's called an 1115 waiver from the federal government to continue this experimental model. Boy, those days are long gone. And, you know, I went from the state of Arizona. President-elect Clinton recruited me to come back and run the intergovernmental office. And the reason for that is that we had a majority of Republican governors, Democratic president. And he said, look, I want to find bipartisan work with these Republican governors. I have progressive ideals. around the environment, around the way we do welfare reform, around the way we do education reform. But I want somebody who can work with everybody. And we did that. We implemented welfare reform. We did a tobacco settlement with the tobacco companies that pays for SCHIP. And when I came home, Governor Napolitano put me on the State Economic Development Board. And we did the first 10-year strategy, economic strategy for the state that was geared on 21st century economy. And it's kind of gathered a lot of dust since then. But at the top of our list was we've got to really upgrade our university. And so I went from there to their universities where I became regent and finished ultimately as chair of the regents. And that's led me to this current.
And you are considering running for governor.
I'm certainly being encouraged to think about it. I mean, I'm at the very embryonic stage. I haven't taken any legal steps. I'm just listening to people's advice and assessing whether the things I care about resonate and whether, pro-business Democrat is a viable commodity in a red-leaning state.
Maybe you could address what your vision is for the state if you were to run for governor and be elected.
Sure. Let's first start with this. In a 21st century economy, capital and workforce is transient. You know, it finds its best opportunities. Let's begin with brand value. Arizona being the butt of national jokes is not helpful in this kind of an economy. And the first thing we've got to do is put a different sort of face, image, brand on the state. We are engaging the 21st century economy. We're mature about what it takes to grow the business platform. We're socially responsible. We're tolerant of diversity. It's a different mix on the brand side. Secondly, is like business, most forward-leaning states have strategic plans. They've matched up their tax code with their education productivity. They've said, okay, what piece of the economy do we want to try and own? How do you create the workforce for it? And how do you incent business development, financial commitments for it? And how do you match up the workforce with the business growth? It's a strategic plan. We don't have one, need one. Then you get into the more sort of granular strategies. I'm fond of saying states really, they only do three things. They educate, medicate, and incarcerate. And fundamentally, the budget operates in those three pockets, and you've got to really get after your return on investment and your strategic application of how it is that you pursue each of those three in a way that marries up to your overall 21st century strategy.
And the one that's going up radically, right, is incarceration.
It is. We have one of the fastest incarceration rates in the country.
These people violent criminals?
It's a mix. It runs the gamut from violent criminals to first-time possession charges. We are one of the states in the 70s that moved to mandatory sentencing, where the judges have very limited discretion. You come in, you've been convicted of a certain kind of a crime, and the discretion of what the length of your sentence is very limited. And so as a result, we don't have much in the way of alternatives to incarceration, so we put everybody in the most expensive form of the corrections industry.
What does it cost to incarcerate
about
people?
About $40,000 a year per head. And it has grown significantly. Actually, the growth in the corrections budget over the past 4 years is roughly equal to the subtraction in the higher education budget.
What can be done about that?
Well, you got to ultimately look at secure alternatives to corrections. Now, we don't want to release criminals in the street. That's not what I'm talking about. But, are there ways in which we can find alternatives to monitor, first-time possession charges and other things, monitor them in a way driven by IT that is absolutely safe and absolutely, basically what they're doing in Texas is that a lot of first-time possession charges, people are walking around with a bracelet on their arm or their leg. Yeah, which,
I was really, really happy when I got to take my ankle bracelet.
Yeah. And there's someone sitting in an office that's monitoring, the folks that are under their charge, a much less expensive way of dealing with these kinds of things. I'm not prepared to say what I think the specific answer is, but one thing I do know is that the rate of incarceration is eating up our ability to invest both in education and, frankly, in tax reform.
Any idea how much, for example, we're spending on arresting people for marijuana usage, just possession?
I've not isolated that number. I believe the corrections budget, if I'm not mistaken, is probably about $500 million a year. I'll have to look at that, but it's significant and growing.
You alluded to the problem earlier of Arizona brand, right, Gary? I mean, around the country, frankly, we're a joke. We worry people. People may still visit here, but a lot of people don't move to Arizona because the politics is, from the governor's office through the legislature, extremely flaky. And you can say, well, the Democrats are this and the Republicans are that, but we've only got one party that, as Mike said last week, is bat crap crazy.
I think angry too.
Yeah.
What the feedback I get from my friends in other states is that Arizona seems very angry and armed, highly armed, which makes it not a very attractive place to come to.
Yeah, I think it scares people. I know that my friends who support, you know, open carry and stuff think that makes everybody safer, but it makes people who visit here kind of nervous. What can we do? You want to change the brand. You want to change the image of Arizona so that we're like Arizona in the 70s, this progressive place. It's conservative in a lot of ways. It's sort of libertarian in a lot of ways, but it's not trying to seize federal national lands. It's not interfering with the reproductive rights of women. It's not trying to take charge over things like that. How can we go from here to there? What would you do that would make us so that we're, so the brand is better, so people have respect for Arizona's government as well as for it, loving its climate and spectacular natural features.
Sure. There are lots of experts in brand. I'm not one of them, but, you know, I've got a few instincts about this. First, you know, brand is in a sense, it's very simple. In another sense, very, very complicated. And brand is a lot of things. You know, the Apple brand is partly personality, partly Steve Jobs, and it's partly great product. That's, I think, where you start. The face you put on Arizona, literally in the form of governor, key business leaders, et cetera, is not a small thing. Secondly, it's the tone. Washington Post recently did a word cloud, did a huge survey with Gallup of words associated with different states. Well, we know what ours was: intolerant, hateful, angry. That's not a place that, you know, that's going to succeed economically. People aren't going to make investments here. So the tone really matters. Creating a place of tolerance, respect for human dignity, respect for one another in spite of our differences. Attitude about Mexico. Now, I think that when we have comprehensive immigration reform, which is clearly coming led by this newly reelected president, we are in a position to really take advantage of it in a rational management of workflow back and forth across the border that is above board, open, transparent, meets the needs and meets the values of our people. We are in a position to take full advantage of it because of our posture, you know, geographically with Mexico. And we've had a hostile relationship with Mexico, clearly. They get it. You know, they're sophisticated folks. And they're doing business with Texas. Texas and California are growing their exports to Mexico significantly, and we are being left behind. So there's a lot of pieces that are part of it. And last is we are perceived as a status quo place with no imagination, and that couldn't be further from the truth. Arizona is filled with imagination. It's what brings us here. We, you know, the big sky, the big horizon is kind of who we are. We do things. We reach for the stars. We're constantly doing things here. But that's not the image. And an entrepreneurial environment as part of our brand, a place where people can start things, do things, get support for new ideas, try innovation, be a part of the new creative economy, take risk. That's all fundamental to a different kind of a brand and ultimately to our success in a new economy.
When I owned an ad agency, we used to be hired by large corporations to do analyses of other states where they might consider opening a plant or opening a business. And what I found was that the last thing that the companies were concerned with was the tax environment of the state. That was part of it, but it was always way at the bottom. Yet it seems like the only business development in the state of Arizona is to lower the tax rate. And the governor now is taking great credit for having growth in the state. Yet our growth is even though it is growing, it's lagging way behind other states. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Sure. No, look, it's a great point. And the growth is call centers. It's, you know, any growth is good to the economy, but it's not the ideal kind of growth. We have had a sequence of very aggressive tax reforms and tax cuts in the last number of years, and we are now viewed, and even Glenn Hammer, the president of the Chamber of Commerce, said we are as competitive as we need to be on the tax side. It is now all about workforce, and we are behind and need to make significant commitments of resources and strategy, cultural expectations in order to create the workforce for people. And I can't tell you the number of CEOs I've dealt with as I've moved around the country who've said, you know, my employees would love to have the Arizona lifestyle. It's a very compelling lifestyle, relatively inexpensive cost of living on a relative basis, et cetera. But they don't want to move there because the political environment is hostile and because they're not sure that their kids are going to have the future that they want for them.
Someone asked me during the dot-com boom, I'm originally from Oklahoma, if the dot-com companies, could they get them to move to Tulsa and Oklahoma City? And I had to say pretty much what you're saying. I said, I don't think so. I don't think anybody's hardly going to move here. And first, there's going to be questions about the Oklahoma education system, which is better than Arizona's maybe, but it's not very good. There's going to be questions about the social life in Arizona. Young people want places to go. I guess let's talk for a second, Fred, about the connection between strong educational system and economic development and bringing in the right kind of jobs. And the right kind of jobs folks, they spread out. So if you're hiring a technician, that means more teachers and so forth and so on. What would you call that, Fred? It permeates the rest of society when you could get high paid. California is, they believe, in 2014 going to be running a governmental surplus. The high income, high educated people around Silicon Valley, they have a strong a state income tax there, and they're headed for a budget surplus. They're recovering now, and Arizona is lagging behind.
Correct. As a fellow Oklahoman, let me start there. Oklahoma actually is making big forward strides, and we are not. I'll tell you why. They doing two things. First is that they understood that they made a commitment to become the back office support capacity for high tech companies all over the world, and they knew that that kind of a worker wanted to live in a creative place. And what Oklahoma City has done with, I believe you might recall, I want to say Stockyards or the Old Town,
the Riverwalk,
is exactly the kind of forward, you know, thinking that needs to happen to recruit those kind of employees. Second, they understand that this natural gas boom is for real. It's a game changer, and getting beyond natural gas in coal to gas plants. Far-reaching thinking about what kind of technology for long-term natural gas applications can exist, and how can Oklahoma make the investments on the workforce side, on the innovation side. Look, Oklahoma's got a long way to go, too. But the point is they're having the conversation, and we're not. But they started with as you would any business, with a discussion of assets and liabilities. What do we have? What do we lack? Where's our opportunity to grow? In Arizona, we have a lot to work with. We've biofuels, algae, informatics, genomic research, DNA, TGen, the Cancer Center. There's a lot to work with. But the fundamental point is that what we, in the big scheme of things, one of Arizona's biggest challenges is wealth, which is, and I'm not talking about, you know, creating billionaires. I'm just simply talking about our per capita income is relatively low. We need to grow wealth in the state of Arizona at all levels, middle class, upper class, et cetera. That requires creating products that the rest of the world will buy, and the rest of the world is buying high technology products. So that's the space we've got to get into, and that requires a combination of tax and education productivity that marries up into creating products and innovation entrepreneurs that will lead to capital formation and ultimately to selling those kind of products.
When you speak of wealth in the state, I'm struck by a little research I did recently about all these people that are for favoring sovereignty and trying to accuse the federal government of intervening. Might be surprised to learn that Arizona receives $1,200 per person, somewhere in that vicinity, per year, more from the federal government than they pay in. And so we're one of the great taker states of the country. I think we rank in the low 30s or 40s, where states like New Jersey and Minnesota and Delaware and New York are putting in about $4,000 to $5,000 a year more than they get back. And the difference is the type of jobs that you're talking about. When you have high-paying jobs that people then are able to contribute more in income taxes. So if we could raise that up, and you know, see if you'd agree, if we could raise that up in states like Arizona, we might be able to overall reduce the tax rate throughout the country.
Absolutely right. And people with those kinds of skills, they're not just, you know, earning a higher living and be able to pay higher taxes, which is a wonderful thing. But they tend to be job creators. They tend to be entrepreneurs. They're comfortable with risk because they can afford risk. And so, you know, hit and miss. Some work, some don't. But they create the kind of economic ecosystem that will spawn other industries. But you've got to really sort of, you know, look at it holistically. How do you get into a mix where people all in the same space, be it, you know, aerospace manufacturing, genetics, biofuel, or whatever, are in the same proximity to each other, mixing up ideas, thinking what's going to work, what's not, where can we raise capital for a different idea, and creating that kind of ecosystem that's sustainable.
I'm struck by the dichotomy with the education system in Arizona. I mean, you would be in a far better position to know, but it seems that our universities are very good and have very ambitious designs and degree programs, where it seems that our high school and elementary school education lags well behind. And so it seems that many of the students coming into the universities are actually coming from other states. Is that true?
Well, certainly not most. There's actually a cap, Regents policy, a cap. Historically, it's been 30%. No more than, and then we try and lure those students to stay with us. They also, look, in the way the financial model of the universities is built, the out-of-state students paying, you know, $17,000, $18,000 a year are subsidizing the cost of the in-state students so that they can go at a more affordable cost. So the out-of-state students is a marginal net plus. But your fundamental point is the right one. We've started behind. We are not producing. We are one of the lower performing states in the percentage of our population getting a university or college degree, community college or university degree, and we need to increase that. Out-of-state students is a piece of it, but ultimately, obviously, you want to do it with your in-state students. We are building the way in which we've designed the universities. They can grow. That piece of it worked, but you've raised the right point. It is the quality of the K-12 productivity. We are not getting enough students coming in the pipeline to fill the seats that we are capable of taking in our university system to turn them out as graduates. And so you're absolutely right. K-12 is ultimately the game changer.
So, Fred, if you were to decide to run for governor, I mean, what would your campaign look like? What would be two or three issues? Do you have it framed out? I know you want Arizona return to a very positive vision and get away from all the nasty arguments about things, either one that we can't do anything about or unconstitutional or just plain silly.
Yes. First and foremost, I want to, you know, change the image of the state. I want to talk about who we are. I believe that, you know, there's a different Arizona waiting to reemerge that's optimistic and forward looking and tolerant and respectful and, you know, gets this conversation about what the rest of the world is getting about what the future economy is going to look like. Secondly, is I want to change the tone. I mean, after my friend Gabby was shot, I started the Institute on Civil Discourse in Tucson at the U of A and got Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush and Katie Couric and Colin Powell to serve as our chairs. That we've got to quit demonizing each other. We've got to have spirited debate. I mean, there's strongly differences of opinion, but we've got to quit demonizing each other in a place where we absolutely, the political cost of finding common ground is so great that we don't move forward. And what my campaign is going to be about is articulating a different vision for the state, that's a more progressive vision to be sure, but that is still rooted in the fundamental need to talk to independents and Republicans about common ground and a common narrative and a common ambition for what we want this special place to be.
So how will you deal with the fear of immigrants? And I mean, the crime rate is going down all over the world. New York City had the lowest murder rate in 40 years. Crime's going down, but the worry about crime is going up. Amount of immigration is illegal immigration is going down, and yet the level of worry rises just as the problem seems to be factually fading.
Dealing with fear is the hardest thing to do in politics because you can, the fear card is a 10-second card, and the data card is a long explanation, and that is fundamentally hard. But ultimately, the data's got to matter. The facts have got to matter, number one. Number two, and that's not to say that there aren't real issues around crime and public safety. There are, and we need to be addressed forthright and aggressively. There's no question about that. But do it on a data-based, smart strategy with rational, you know, proven strategies both in the urban space and on the border as to what works and what doesn't work. And then get beyond the fear card to the hope card, which is fundamentally, I think, much more American and much more who we are as Westerners and as Americans to think about the next century and to think about what it is that we leave behind.
I think one of the things that strikes me, I don't know about Gary, is this was the America was the company of a country of optimism, of forward looking, of progress, of can do, and we've just fallen into this morass of negativism and a feeling that we can't do anything. Other countries are moving ahead of us in many, many ways. They're innovating, whether it's solar power or whatever.
I track it a lot to the end of the Fairness Doctrine. I've mentioned this before, but we now have 90+% of talk radio is right-wing radio. And these people, I listen to it on a regular basis. These people are really constantly fomenting a paranoia of our government and of each other. You know, the whole thing of arming ourselves is all driven by, or I don't think it's exclusively, but it is largely driven by people like Rush Limbaugh who are saying you need to be fearful of your government. You need to arm yourself. You don't let them take your assault rifles away from you. And I think that has changed the public discourse.
Without question. And of course, the temptation, is to, for the other side of the political, arena to answer in kind. That is it's a race to the bottom. It's a race to the demise of a functioning democratic system. And we can all watch this extraordinary country with still filled with so much promise. And we can watch it stall out as we point our finger at the other side and say,
we
it was
do
their
seem
fault.
As a country, not only as a state, to kind of stalled out. We don't have any big visions. This is the country who innovated, just building highways, interstate highway system. We had the space program. We generated all these products and stuff. And now we seem to have fallen into, we're sort of stuck in our ways. We're kind of, what would you call arterial sclerosis of the mind in terms of a vision. Can you win public office on a positive vision rather than playing to people's fears? Isn't that the question?
It is a great question. Obviously, Barack Obama did it. Now his campaign, I'm sure whoever's out there right now thinking, oh yeah, but they had negative ads too. Yes, they did. But fundamentally, his first campaign was much more the hope card than the fear card. So yes, it can be done. He was a special guy, special gift, first African-American president, et cetera. There was a lot obviously going for him. Can I do it? I don't know. But here's what I believe. And, I have the benefit of having been in politics a long time and I'm getting older. I'm, 58. If I'm ever going to run for office, this will be the only time I do it. And I really believe that campaigns aren't just about winning, but about creating a platform to accomplish something. And so if you don't run on anything, you don't have license to do anything. And that's how I'm going to approach it.
I've heard you speak on a couple of occasions, and one of the things that stands out to me is the optimism. I never hear any attacks of the other side. All I hear is, our options to improve our lot as a state and as a country. So I commend you for that, and I hope that's...
I think you can disagree with Fred about a lot of things, but I think his shift of emphasis to what can be done, to a positive sense of the American policy, possibilities is a really good one. We're about to run out of time, Fred. Any last words? at least on this program, not final last words.
I hope if I decide to do this in due course, you'll have me back. Always lovely to be in Sedona. And, I've got a lot of history here. I've been very involved in the Keep Sedona Beautiful campaign through the years. Was actually sort of an unpaid consultant back in the day. And it's a joy to be here and see the roundabouts fully panned out and then, kind of all the new features, bike paths and so forth. And, it's a very, very, very special place. And, this notion of how it is that Arizona as a special place to live and work, there is no better place to talk about that than Sedona, and it's going to be a fundamental part of anything that I do talk about if I decide to do this, or frankly, if I don't decide to do this, I'm still going to be out on the hustings talking about what we can become.
We have 2 years of podcast on our website, vvid.org, and you can hear Fred's talk, and you can hear 2 years now almost.
Right? He'll be in Cottonwood in February to talk to the Democrats of the Verde Valley.
Great. Well, it's great having you here, Fred, and we'll have you up if you do decide to run for governor at some point in the future. And we try to bring you a lot of different points of view, folks, and I think this is one that you needed to hear. You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.